been using the same makeup line for 4 years now, whether I'm adding a touch of mascara to feel and look refreshed with their Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara by Thrive Cosmetics for an everyday look, or I'm going all out with their highlighter, eyeliner, and eyeshadow for a full glam, I love, love, love applying Thrive Cosmetics to my face. The quality is impeccable, and they support a great cause, of course. It's even in their name. I mean, Thrive Cosmetics. C-A-U-S-E Medics. Thrive Cosmetics and Bigger Than Beauty Skincare empower customers, employees, and giving partners to live confidently, and they practice responsive giving, donating high-performance products or much-needed funds to help communities thrive. And I can't emphasize enough how great their mascara is. Their unique formula creates tubes around each eyelash, lengthening them beautifully. I do feel like a doll. It's super easy to remove and just slides right off with warm water. No smudging. Amazing. Plus, the nourishing ingredients support longer, stronger, and healthier looking lashes over time. Can't go wrong. And as someone with blonde eyebrows, by the way, I appreciate their Infinity Waterproof Eyebrow Liner. This easy to use waterproof pencil holds like a wax and blends like a powder. And you can align your brows to give them structure and create natural looking strokes to fill in sparse areas. It even comes with a spoolie brush to lift and tame your brows after application. So with 8 shades to choose from, it adjusts to your natural brow color for a perfect match every time. It's just lovely. It's wonderful. So refresh your everyday look with Thrive Cosmetics, luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get 10% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/magic. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/magic for 10% off your first order.
But when you're in that state, the LSD kind of opens you up to like how beautiful it is. It stops being a scary thing. And that's a lot of it with the spiritual path is too, is can you love the fear as much as you love the joy, right? Can you love the pain as much as you love the happiness or the pleasure? And so LSD really opens that up, and that's what I was feeling, is like not scared or not sad that my life is so short in comparison to, say, the mountain that is Annapurna being millions of years old. It's more so a thankfulness that I get to experience that thought at all, that realization that, wow, I'm something right here, seeing some other aspect of myself.
Imagine if this world did not have any plastic.
It'd be a wonderful world.
I know. Do you think that by 2060, that's a possibility?
No.
Really?
No, I don't.
How about 2100?
Yeah, I think by 2100 for
really?
Sure.
Really?
Yeah, definitely.
I hope so. I bet that they'll have... You know what? I think that they're going to find, or the universe is somehow going to create some sort of mineral that the second it touches plastic, it evaporates and it just does not exist. Not in any way, shape, or form.
I think scientists discovered certain microbes that eat plastic and like dissolve it completely, but I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that. Not 100%. I feel like I've seen it somewhere before though.
Maybe you dreamt it. I feel like that would be kind of a big deal if like that was a thing.
Well, it's easy to do things on a small scale scientifically, but to make it like a large scale project is a whole nother deal. And to make it a worldwide thing is even like farther off. So there's like, I don't know, I read a lot of stuff on like futurology.
Futurology?
Yeah, futurology is like the study of like the future kind of, and like what's going to be coming, like what we're discovering in science.
That's exciting.
Yeah, and so there's lots of, you see tons of random little tidbits every couple of days on like different like simple and effective cures for cancer that have been shown in laboratory results, and like
wow,
microbes that eat plastic and different things like that. Just really uplifting stuff. But then you never really hear about it again because obviously it's not something monetizable or something a corporation wants to invest in.
Of course, because it's a risk. It's a super risk. By the way, speaking of risk, like how toasty are you right now?
I'm great.
Really? I feel like you're going to be burning up in the midst of this podcast.
No, this thing is like a big bear hug.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of loud though. Is it loud?
Nah.
I hope not.
Where do you get this futurology information?
Reddit.
Really?
Yeah, of Reddit's course. The best.
You're like all
I'm on
about Reddit,
like, every day. Reddit's wonderful.
Do you have like people gossiping about Vishuddha on Reddit?
Not that I know of.
I'm gonna check
probably
this out.
Random stuff everywhere, but I just go on there to like read uplifting news and like discovering stuff, especially philosophy. There's lots of like good philosophy conversations on there.
What are some of your favorite philosophical philosophies?
Absurdism. Absurdism is really powerful by Albert Camus.
Yeah?
He was like a philosopher. He wrote a book called The Stranger.
I feel like I've heard of that.
Stranger is really good. Okay. It's like a storybook, but it's very philosophical. It's just basically about how the absurd nature of existence and the purposelessness of it, I guess. But not in a scary way, more of like an incredible way. Like, look how crazy and ridiculous this all is.
Life is so ridiculous. Life is so absurd.
Yeah.
Everything that we're doing. Our trek was so absurd.
That was.
Who are we? Why did we do that? But that
Why
was the
are
best
these little
thing in my
humans
life.
Pushing themselves to their limit just to get up into the mountains and look at the mountains from closer up?
Truly the limit. My Truly. Knee is out.
Yeah, you can't walk right now. You got like a stick leg.
I know. I'm limping. Oh, poor me. All right. Let's ground. Let's pray. How do you usually start your prayers?
I don't really do prayers, to be honest. I do. I set like intentions and mantras in my head. Like when I do my morning like puja and arti and stuff like that. But I don't like pray or anything.
Will you guide us through one?
Oh, it's mainly honestly it's not it's like chanting a mantra over and over again.
Okay.
Like,
what's like, one mantra that comes to mind right now?
One of the biggest ones that I use is Jai Ma Kali, Jai Ma Kali, Jai Ma Kali.
That's how Jai Ma Kali. Yeah, I introduced the podcast Jai Ma. There's something about that introduction, that greeting, that is so beautiful, and apparently it also does reference the divine feminine in it.
Yeah. Well, Jai Ma is it's a short version of Jai Ma Kali. So Ma in Jai Ma is a reference to Ma Durga, who is one of her forms is Kali, Kali Ma.
Speaking of Kali, we have to share the story. Let's do a little prayer, and then we'll go straight into the Kali story.
Let's do it.
Okay. Jai Ma Kali, may we use this valuable time to deeply connect and share, deliver a shared truth, share whatever message that comes through. And may I just express my gratitude, immense gratitude for Vishuddha. So much for not only this trek, but also just being an amazing friend in my life for all these years now. And to finally have this experience together and for everything that, all his support this entire time. I'm so thankful that he's taken this time to do this podcast for the yomis. And so whatever unfolds, may it be so. Aho.
Aho.
That feels good.
Oh, I like it.
Kali.
Kali. Kali
we
Ma.
We saw an incarnation of her.
We did.
No
we
big
did.
Deal.
No big. You know what's crazy is this week has been so insane that I forgot about that.
Same.
Until you just brought it up. I was like, oh yeah, we met what the Nepalese consider to be an incarnation, a physical incarnation of the mother.
Yeah.
Kumari, that's her name, Kumari.
Kumari, yes.
Yeah, that was really interesting.
That was fierce. That was intense. And it's interesting that we all had a different perspective as to what her energy represented.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I love that you prefaced it by saying that the Nepalese feel that she is the incarnation.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because I was like, how do I feel about this?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think a lot of people is they think the way a certain culture sees something is universal, or we take it as universal, but really it's understanding it's part of that culture. You know, it's part of the Nepalese culture to see it that way.
Yeah.
It's not something, you know, you'd see around the world or, you know, in America or somewhere else for certain people. But in certain areas of the world, they have their own views and their own practices. So I think it helped by prefacing it that way too, is like the Nepalese people see it that way. It helps you understand not only where it's from, but how it can kind of stem from the people in that region. Mm-hmm. And then also it helps you not to group a bigger picture together, you know, not to like throw everybody who might believe in Kali as, oh, they must all also believe and see the mother as this girl, you know.
Exactly. Some people might actually, I was wondering if there's anybody that took offense to it.
Yeah.
That might even be in India. That it's like, you know, they're deeply rooted in their Hindu beliefs that are completely different, yet very similar. Where does it, do you know where Kali stems from? Because I know she's the divine goddess, the death, the destroyer, the death of the ego, the death of...
Yeah, Kali Ma is just one of the many incarnations of Durga. So Durga is essentially the divine feminine, the Devi, Shakti in her many forms. But she shows most prominently in the union between Shiva and Parvati.
Yeah.
So Shiva and Parvati is like that divine union, that divine marriage between the two.
Mm-hmm.
But through that, Durga manifests as Parvati and as Kali. And depending on, again, which sect of Hindu philosophy you follow, some people see one as above the other or the original, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So same thing with, let's say, like Lord Vishnu, who's like the preserver of existence. The Hare Krishnas, the monks, see Lord Krishna as the supreme personality of Godhead. So they see Krishna as above Vishnu, whereas the rest of Hindus see Vishnu as like the originator and Krishna as an incarnation. So
yeah.
Same with Kali. Some see Kali as like the origination. Some see Kali as an incarnation of Durga. Regardless, yeah, Kali is essentially, well, Kala is what her name stems from, the K-A-L-A, which represents time. Kala means time. Infinite, and she in her color especially represents that infinite nature. So the reason I think Kali is so powerful is because she represents just the absolute fierceness of love, of devotion, of mother's passion to help her children awaken at all costs. You know, she's so viciously caring about her children and about this existence and about helping us awaken and slaying our own internal demons and removing our ego illusions, that she can get so lost in it, she almost destroys the planet. You know, that's how much love she has for her children, which we are. And that's why a lot of the depictions of Kali show her, you know, stepping on Shiva, because she was going so crazy slaying these demons that Shiva had to pretty much put himself in her path to stop her. That's how much love she has. It's just like a level of passion that we can't fathom as humans. You know, she's that perfect divine archetype representing our own personal ability to awaken and rid ourselves of these demons and of these illusory ways of living that can easily harm us.
I see why she keeps popping up into my world now, because I grew up thinking that the way to show your love is to be so soft and gentle and just approach it in that very nurturing way in how we have this picture idea of what a motherly loving figure is. We think sweet, we think flowery, we think dresses and baked cookies, you know? But no, there's another kind of love that has the fire, that has the passion, that has that fierceness behind it. And that indeed keeps popping into my world for whatever reason. What's interesting as well, it just popped into my mind, is when we had the retreat, something happened when we went out to a waterfall, and in a sense, some of the girls, it seemed, were being treated unfairly by some of the locals, and the locals took like $15 from them because the girls didn't end up using their service. And like my Kali energy, my fire, my fierceness like came out. A side that people that listen to this podcast do not often see, because I have a fire. And like, I ground, I'm gentle when I'm talking here.
Yeah.
But I've got this fierceness. And so to really just embrace that fire, I mean, I am a double Leo after all. Like I've got a lot of fire. And so to just embrace that Kali energy inside is so freeing, to know that there's another way to show love.
Yeah, and it's interesting because coming into that fierceness, it requires a lot of internal practice. You know, a lot of, I think in the Western world, our fierceness is negative.
Yes.
So I think that's also why so many people, when they first see Kali, they're like, wow, she's really scary. Mm. She looks like a nightmare. Like, why would I want to look at this picture? Why would I want to devote to this picture, have it hanging in my room? It scares so many people.
Yeah.
And it's because we associate fierceness with fear, or fierceness with negativity. Mm-hmm. And we're not used to seeing fierceness as like an empowering part of our lives. That's why Ram Dass calls like spiritual practice a fierce grace. You know, fierce grace is what it takes. Oh. And it's what we are really striving towards, is to have fierce grace, to like seek that fierce grace, to experience fierce grace. Is that how deep that power goes, how deep that experience goes, how deep that surrender goes in your own life, that devotion goes. If you can like allow that fire to burn within you, no matter what you do, you know, you can be fiercely meditating if it takes it. Just how much devotion do you have to it? How much compassion and how committed to it are you? So same thing when you see, I guess you could say students being taken advantage of, your fierce love takes over, right?
Yes.
You can be in that soft space of love 24/7, but when that fierceness has to come out, if you are on your path and if you're in alignment with your practice, you know that you're doing it in a progressive way and in a way that helps you and helps others rather than it being an inherently negative thing, which is, I think, how, unfortunately, a lot of the Western world, again, sees the idea of anything fierce at all.
That is so true. It's very triggering for a lot of people. It is. When I posted a fierce photo, there was definitely an interesting reaction to it as well. When people have created an image of you of being so gentle, I almost want a tattoo of that, fierce grace. Like, yes. Those two words, there's something about that that was like, I don't know if you felt it with me, but yeah, I was like, oh my gosh.
It's powerful.
That is so powerful, fierce grace. There's something about Kali that just keeps coming up. Mm. A lot of different synchronicities with Kali that just kept popping up in Bali and even prior to Bali. And then I come here and we just happen to walk into this home and I had no idea what we're doing. I'm just like, sure, Vishuddha, let's go on here.
Let's do it.
And it just happens to be where this living goddess is, that happens to be an incarnation of Bali according to the Nepali folk. And then we left that place. So we were just there for a while and I was like, I don't feel like her here. I don't feel like there's anything. It feels almost tainted with a lot of tourist energy, so I kind of want to go and continue on, but you guys want to stay, so I'll just chill, I guess. And then we went on and it was just beautiful, and we saw at a shrine of Kali, and this guy was talking about Kali. He was an older man that I thought he had another agenda, but he actually didn't. He had a pure...
He's just a nice old man.
He was just a nice man talking about Kali, but I always have a guard up, because I'm like, all right, you want to take my time because you want money or something more,
especially when traveling too,
because of traveling
you have to kind of have your guard up a bit.
When you're a tourist, and we've been around the block,
you know,
exactly. What I mean, so we have our guard up. We weren't born yesterday. And then we went and we just walked around for a while, and you just had this random nudge. All of a sudden, it was just a spontaneous ping. You're like, I want to go back.
It was mother's nudge. It was
mother's nudge.
Which is interesting, too, because... So, I've been practicing Hindu Dharma, or the Hindu faith, now for close to 3 years. And the branch I practice in is called Vedanta, or Dvaita Vedanta, the non-dual path of Vedanta. But the temple in which I study, we are students of Ramakrishna. His name's Paramahansa Ramakrishna. He was an Indian saint in the late 1800s. And he was a massive, massive bhakta, or loving devotee of Mother Kali. So Mother Kali like runs through it with the entire temple. We learn about her all the time and about Ramakrishna's infinite like obsession. Not even obsession, but just deep, deep, pure love for Mother, and seeing Mother in everything and crying for Mother and calling to Mother. He would often say, to awaken, you have to long for Mother the same way a drowning man longs for a breath of air. It has to be that much of a need. It can't even be just a maybe or a want. It has to be, again, that absolute fierceness, that commitment. And so ever since then, it's interesting, because before that, I had never really known who Mother Kali was. And then once that happened, everywhere I've traveled now, I've always seen her. So when I first went to Bali, the very first water temple I went to, the very first one, it was a very small one, like far up past the main rice paddies, far up past the main, I guess you could say, tourist water temples.
Which
where everybody goes.
Do.
Yeah, it was a very small local one. We only saw locals there. It was just four of us, a few of my Hindu friends. And so we went there, and of course, the only deity at the bottom, it's a very small waterfall, is Mother Kali.
Of course.
The only one.
So,
of course, I was like, oh, yeah, Mother's here. Not surprised. And then, same thing, first day in, again, Nepal now. Come to Nepal, go to the square as the very first thing to do, and here's where Mother's physical incarnation lives. So it's synchronistic, but for me, it's like, of course she's going to be here. Like, of course she's going to be in my path again. Of course she's going to keep presenting herself to me, which is a really kind of interesting thing to question why that is. But that's how it kind of felt when we were in front of remember, we thought the statue was Kali initially, but it was Bhairav. It's a version of Shiva. So it's
why was he talking about Kali for so long? Right?
Because it's like the masculine form of Kali.
Okay.
Not specifically, but it looks almost
identical
to Kali.
It was a very unique one,
So it looks very much like Mother Kali. But then once that happened, like you said, I just had this kind of draw to go back. I felt like if we went back, we might see her, and we did.
That's what you thought? You're like, maybe we might see her, so we
I just had
go
a
back.
Feeling that she would... I knew she was there, like I could feel Kumari's Something. Energy, like when we were there, but she wasn't showing herself.
See, I couldn't... Yeah. I didn't feel like she was...
I knew she was there. I could just sense her presence, I guess you could say. because that's the house. And I doubt, you know, it's such a deeply religious thing that she would be able to leave the house, especially as a young child. Mm. So I could kind of feel that she was in there. But I didn't know which room. You know, there are so many different rooms at the very top.
Maybe she just wasn't around the top. Maybe she was, like, in her own little...
Yeah, it had to be somewhere. But after that, I was just like, we have to go back before we leave, definitely to just see. Just for me, it's just intuition, especially with traveling. You get, I don't know, I feel like I really try to trust my intuition as much as I can to, like, go places. Even if I have to go back to a place again, it's always kind of worth it to me. And that's why, I guess, situations like that present themselves.
So worth it. When she was at that top, the energy was so different.
It was Kali's energy. It was Mother's energy.
It was fierce.
Yeah.
Then, put our phones away because you're not allowed to take a picture of her.
Yeah, no pictures of her.
Totally honor that. Super sacred. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm thankful for that so we could be so present in that moment where she came out and looked at everybody. She just presented herself for how long was it? Maybe like 10, 15 seconds?
Maybe 15 seconds, yeah, 20 seconds max.
It was 20 seconds max. But that short window of time was so powerful. It's embedded in my brain and I'm never going to forget it. And I made eye contact with her for a millisecond. I know that wasn't good. I don't think that was good.
Why is that?
I don't think you're allowed to. I don't think
you can make eye contact with her, really? I'm pretty sure. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, because we literally made, like, eyeballed, like, you and I right now. Like, it was a millisecond.
And it's interesting, like you said, how everybody's, because of our own psychology, our perception of who she is and what she is and how she felt is totally different between everybody there.
Everybody had their own different version. I'm trying to remember Haley's, but yours was interesting and then mine was definitely very different. So mine, I looked at her and I was like, her fierceness, which I now also see after talking with you, because that, you know, you can definitely skew your perception or just change it a bit, alter it a bit if something does seem more light or does resonate more. But in that moment I was like, oh, she's like a six-year-old girl, by the way, this living goddess. She's 6 years old.
Yeah, she's very, very young.
She's very, very young. And, you know, the world knows who she is.
She's taken care of by the government.
She's taken care of by the government. Yeah, and so in my mind, when I saw her, I was like, she doesn't feel free. She doesn't feel like a child. And she didn't seem like she wanted to be there.
Yeah.
She had this, like, ugh, this is, I do not like to do this. I'm about to cry. I don't want to see you guys right now. I just want to, like, go and live my life. That's how I felt.
Yeah.
And you felt something.
And so for me, it was absolutely day and night different. For me, it was like as if she was saying, I am Mother Kali. I am the infinite. Mm-hmm. Like, feast your eyes on me. See this fully. Feel this. I hope this makes you uncomfortable. Like, can you take what you're seeing right now? Can you accept what you're feeling right now in my presence, you know? And just, to me, it was like, whoa, so powerful. Oh, my gosh.
And when you said that, I felt so jealous of you, because I was like, man, I wish I saw that.
Yeah, and I think, too, because, like, I was looking for, like, any kind of flicker of, like, feeling of, like you said, like, sadness or fear, and her gaze was just stone, like, pure, just, like, which is mother's fierceness, that pure fierceness, unflinching, unwavering for that entire 20 seconds. And then she just turned around like it was nothing to her, and went back into the room.
Like,
that's why
nothing,
for me,
it was like
she knew exactly what she was, and she could feel it, and she literally embodied it.
She's like, this is it.
Yeah,
you guys see me. But that guy that was outside when we were looking at the one shrine that I talked about earlier, that I was worried he had another agenda. He was in there.
He actually came in there after we went there.
Well, that's what surprised me. I was like, wait a second. He never even told us to go there. He truly was just so happy to talk about Kali.
Yeah.
Like, it's hilarious. He was just so in love with that. And then he goes in there and he actually happens to be hired by the government to talk about Kali. And so I'm like, oh, okay. And I asked him, I was like, this was before I talked to you about everything. Yeah. I was like, did she like being there? He's like, she didn't seem happy today. No, she didn't, you know, like, so I guess maybe she's a human. So she has different sides to her where she's probably more willing to do it than others. Mm-hmm. But regardless, she still had a fierceness and like, I know who I am. Mm-hmm. And so hi. Bask in this for a second.
Yeah.
You know?
Another thing too is with Kali, like, Kali doesn't even represent happiness. Like, in no way does she ever appear happy. She appears like she's screaming a lot of the times, like holding herself back from like exploding almost with so much like rage and anger, but not in a negative sense, in a loving sense, you know, that just intensity that it's hard for us to fathom in our human form, because we rarely feel those feelings at the same like level of devotion and care. So for me, it's like reading so much about her and studying so much the nature of Kali. Yeah, like you said, it's really interesting to, I think it's also good to be able to talk to people about how they see these things, mm-hmm. because it's all based on our perception, right? I have a lot of study and meditation on her, so I'm going to see Kumari in a different light than someone who has no study on it, or very little study on it, or who is seeing it in a more humanized way, where I'm seeing it more in a religious way, because I've been, like I said, spending 5 months in India, so.
And aren't you also baptized Hindu? Or something like
that. Oh, yeah, initiation. Yeah, so it's called the Diksha in Hindi. But it's like receiving initiation from Diksha. A guru and everything. Yeah.
Baptized Diksha.
Reborn Hindu.
Yeah, you are. Wow. Okay.
I'd like to share something important with all the women tuning in, as many of us encounter fluctuations in our hormones at some point in our life, whether it's related to cortisol or estrogen or testosterone levels. The effects can manifest in various ways, like sleep disturbances, changes in appetite, bloating, discomfort. You know, you've likely been there. And so regardless of age or situation, Happy Mammoth, the creator of Hormone Harmony, is committed to simplifying women's lives. They prioritize using scientifically backed ingredients proven effective for women without compromising on quality. Hormone Harmony isn't just tailored for menopause. Any woman experiencing changes in her hormone levels can benefit from it. Whether you're dealing with disrupted sleep, persistent fatigue, occasional bloating or discomfort, loss of intimacy drive, or racing thoughts and mild mood swings, or perhaps even hot flashes and night sweats if you're going through menopause or perimenopause. I mean, Hormone Harmony addresses these issues comprehensively, and one of its most significant advantages happens to be helping women feel like themselves again, which is a sentiment that is echoed in a multitude of reviews, over 17,000 to be exact. And so, for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code MAGIC at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code MAGIC for 15% off today.
You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 2 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
Well, I want to shift gears a second because we just have to talk about... Well, I guess, you know, we'll lead into it a little bit because I definitely want to talk about LSD and psychedelics because your experience with all of that is so fascinating.
Yeah.
And I am curious to explore because I've only done half a mushroom with Ali in Kauai. And so that literally did like nothing, but just had a nice long meditation where the Dalai Lama meditated, you know?
Nice.
Yeah, I told you about it, right? Because it's sacred.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll just talk about the trek for a moment.
Yeah,
and then
because
when you got to the top, that's where you had experience.
I had some LSD.
Yes! We indeed had embraced Lucy and the sky with diamonds up in the sky in Annapurna area.
I felt it was a good way and place to celebrate was to dive deeper into myself and into the experience. And we had such a limited time there too. You know, if we would have, I probably wouldn't have taken LSD up there if we had a few days to stay at Annapurna Base Camp and like take it all in. But we only had a few hours. So for me,
we did.
And that's the power of psychedelics. If you use them consciously and intentionally, is that they can act as these almost, I guess you would say,
time warps.
These time warps of spiritual tools that can help you not only take in experiences more deeply, but almost like you said, shift time and slow time down, or even speed time up so that you process more of what you're seeing and experiencing in a shorter amount of time. So whereas I could have maybe taken in 3 days of meditation or so and thought and processed what was going on and what it was like to be at this colliding, powerful, volatile place on the planet where two continents are literally meeting and pushing these mountains higher in the air than ever before. I mean, this is literally the highest mountain range on the planet. If I would have had more time, like I said, I wouldn't have used LSD, but I had it in my possession. You know, I have it with me, and I figured since I only have a few hours, I might as well drop do what Timothy Leary says, turn on, tune in, and drop out, something like that, and just kind of let it speak to me. And that's kind of what the thing was, is since I was there, why not utilize this medicine and let the mountains kind of talk to me for a bit and let me be the student instead of me try to control the experience, which is what we almost always do 99% of the time in our lives.
You were so patient during that entire trek, by the way. So we'll go to the trek, but well, we're talking LSD now. So you know what? We're going to skip ahead. We'll talk about the trek in a little bit, but you
gotta get to the juicy stuff first.
We'll just get to the juice. We'll cut straight to, I'll, you know what? I'll give them a quick summary. We had a long trek up there. Every day we walked about 10 to 12 miles uphill, downhill. My knee started to really, really cause me a lot of problems. I was way behind. Vish was always like the very first one, Vishada, I call him Vish. So he was always like way ahead, even though he also has a pretty hurt knee too, but he's been living on it. Anyways, long story short, I'm very thankful for his patience with me during that entire time. And yeah, there's not too much to say about the trek, minus the fact that we did, there were a lot of moments internally for each of us that we could probably talk about. But when we get to the top, that's when a lot of stuff started to unfold for both of us. Like, definitely. I was processing a lot. You had your experience with LSD, and it was so beautiful to witness.
Yeah.
So beautiful to witness. Did you record two videos on it, too, as well?
Yeah, I filmed two videos on LSD.
So you, I don't know when those are going to be out, but indeed.
They'll be out, if this, depending on when this comes out, they'll definitely be out. Yeah, they'll be out in sometime in December, January area.
Oh, perfect.
But for sure, they'll be out.
Okay, so you're going to have to definitely keep your eye out for both of those.
Yeah,
because you talked about very interesting topics, as always.
Yeah.
It was just interesting because I asked you about your experience. And I think you were still, like, processing it or something.
Yeah, but,
like,
still in the midst of it when you asked me. And I was like, I can't answer that yet.
Because
it's still happening.
I can't. But the thing is, like, and your answer and just the way you present yourself is so friendly and kind. And you don't feel like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. You know, it's like, thank you. Okay, I got you.
Yeah, no judgment ever.
Yeah, exactly. And you truly, like, are the real deal and live by that. And it's so beautiful. Beautiful to see. And it's refreshing to have around for a male energy. Because I know a lot of females that feel that have that too, and it's just so nice and refreshing to be around, like Haley as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but like it's so rare to have that male energy that embodies that.
I think it's just because, you know, I think it's only a rare thing in men at least, because we don't take a lot of time to ourselves. And that for me is, you know, spending a year in jail when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and then living on my own for the past couple of years. I spent a lot of time in solace, and so it gave me a lot more space to be patient with myself. Mm. And then my last relationship was really a learning lesson, too, of inner patience. And so all that combined led to a space where it's a lot easier to be patient than it might have been for me just even a few years ago, you know.
Wow.
I think that's something a lot of men need to take more, I think, interest in, especially is taking more space for themselves in their own isolation, because men are very social in the sense they feel like they always have to be around their friends or be with somebody, you know, rather than hanging out on their own and being in their own space.
Well, even if they are an introvert, let's say, and they like to be alone, do they really take that time to really dive deep within themselves?
And
I think
that's
the scariest part.
Yeah, a lot of men that are introverts, but they're online and playing video games or, like, on forums and stuff, chatting. It's always us trying to, like, fill
our
time.
Not just men, by the way.
Yeah, everybody.
Women will
try
to block the real stuff that's going on with finding forms of entertainment in other ways, even if they're an introvert. Because I've had experiences myself as an introvert, like, when I realize that I am trying to suppress something and not just face something and let something go. I'm trying to suppress something when I overconsume. I'm like, I'm overconsuming right now. What am I hiding?
Yeah, and that consumerism is just what I was going to say. It's a big societal reliance on escapism, on like finding a way to escape.
Exactly.
And I think that's why, you know, I was sober for 5 years until this year, and I started traveling and reintroducing psychedelics and plant medicine and such to my life. So 5 years of sobriety, you can't use getting high or getting drunk as an excuse to escape your own awareness. You have to sit with it and process it. So that at least helped me a lot, get used to being with myself and being more present whatever I'm doing. Because like you said, so many people, the vast majority of people can be introverts and can be on their own, but they're utilizing escapist methods to basically forget that they're alone, to fill it with something else that distracts them from actually sitting with their own thoughts, their own mind, their own emotions, and processing it in a healthy way.
So not even alone, but alive.
Yeah.
They're forgetting that they're alive.
Mm-hmm.
like, we're here as humans to experience whatever we're experiencing. We're going to have these challenges, and you're just going to keep facing those challenges until, and everybody listening, most people probably know this, like, it will just continue to come around until you can sit with it and see it and see that pattern that continues to reoccur. I'm curious how you approach facing something and then letting it go. Maybe reoccurring patterns or something that you see in your life, or just some sort of perspective you want to shift, a lens you want to shift, or feelings you want to shift, characteristics you've wanted to transform.
I think the hardest part for me was always accepting those things. So the first step is always the hardest for me, is with acceptance of, like, seeing them. I think for so long I would ignore it completely until it was, like, right on top of me. Like, I could be ignoring things until it was, like, crushing me into pure anxiety. And I'm like, I can't breathe. Why? And then I'm like, okay, I have to face this. I have to admit this. I have to accept this. So that's what a lot of us do. And that's what I did for so long, was just deny it until it was right on top of me. So now it's kind of trying to see things before they can grow into these big, giant problems and uproot them at the source. That was always the hardest part for me. And that's what I try to do a lot more of now. Like, a few years ago, over the past few years, my biggest thing was the stubbornness of still learning from others. Because before I was in my last relationship, I was in a space where I was just teaching myself, and I was learning online, and I was learning from my Swami, and that's pretty much it. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but subconsciously I built this mentality of, I know what I need to know. You know, I don't need to know more. I got it figured out. And so then once new people came into my life, that's just a spiritual ego talking.
Yeah.
Little did I know. Once new people started coming into my life and, like, saying, hey, this could be done, or this could be changed, or this could be helped, my whole ego mind would be like, no, I got to figure it out. I don't need that help. You're just making it harder for me. You're making it more complicated. All these different excuses to not actually change things that would help me. And it took me a long time to really lubricate back up and open back up to the idea that I can always be taking that kind of constructive criticism from people to help me better myself. And that's a thing I think a lot of us need to learn to do, because we get stuck in our ways. Whether it be our material ways or our spiritual ways, we get stuck in it, and that can really hinder us in a lot of ways.
Oh, that is big. Yeah. I love that you just said that. The spiritual ego can be so, so loud.
It's a nasty little bugger.
It is such a nasty, and mine had been very, very loud for so long, but it was in a different way. Very similar, in a sense where I was like, I know it all. I've got this. I'm good, guys. I feel okay. Don't worry about me. Though inside, I am not facing all of the sadness that just wanted to be faced and released, just to let go. It's not like it just didn't need to be in there anymore. But I didn't want to take that first step of accepting it.
Yeah. And I think a big thing too is, like, I would even call it, like, the facilitator paradox, is once you start to, like, share these philosophies and teach them, you get this subconscious air of, I can't have any issues, or else I can't do what I do. So I know so many other teachers, and I'm sure there's lots of listeners here that, like, are starting their own personal brands and creating their own, you know, wellness stuff and teaching and things. A big thing is that we get caught in what's called imposter syndrome. You know, an imposter syndrome is the feeling that I don't actually live what I'm teaching, or I don't feel what I'm teaching. I feel like maybe if people really knew me, they wouldn't think I was this way. But it's like, we're all that big messed up jumble of emotions and thoughts. We're just trying to make the best of it. And the best of it is learning how to teach, learning how to provide in the ways we do. But yeah, so many different spiritual teachers and practitioners that I know have that exact same issue, where they feel like, if I share this thing, or if I try to tell others about it, I have to already have it all figured out. Yeah. And it's like, that's not how it works. We're all figuring it out all the time, but we can still help each other to do so at the same time. So it can be we can be walking both paths at once. Whereas, you know, I thought for a long time I had to be ahead of my own issues all the time, which is almost impossible to do. You can't outrun your shadow, you know.
You definitely cannot ever outrun your shadow. It's going to be lingering there.
It's always there.
But it's extra hard when you are so loved and you receive all these compliments. And I'm like, you know, your audience saw you as, this guy has all the answers to the universe and all my problems in spirituality. And I've also experienced the same thing. And I think that it kind of put me in this box that made me feel, it was probably imposter syndrome or something very similar.
You're thinking maybe, like, they think I have it figured out, so why don't I think I have it figured out?
Yeah.
Yeah, you get those feelings.
Well, and then, my mind, though, would tell me, oh, you got it all figured out. But my heart and my soul was like, Yeah. No, that you've still got to experience this. And the universe was like, we're going to put you through some shit so you can, like, really experience what you're teaching.
Yeah.
So you can really, really teach it and really understand it. And guess what? If you don't really know what you're teaching, don't teach it. So now I'm like, all right, I'll listen to people talk about it. But, you know, if I really don't feel it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to teach it.
It's like that. Have you seen that comic of that little cartoon character sipping tea in, like, the burning house? And it's like, this is fine. And then it's like face starts melting and it's like, everything's okay.
I'm fine.
Just lying to itself, even though it's like dying, it's being eaten alive. So that's what I always think of. It's like, you don't want to let yourself get to that point. So, and what I also realize is that you gain so much more and you start to see who really is in your life and who really matters, and you make meaningful relationships when you learn to start being vulnerable and talking about it and opening up about it and researching it and entering discussions and going to different places and seeing people, whatever it might be, that helps you heal.
And those people that when you finally, like, come out of that closet in a sense, like, they end up seeing you and then they come back around because they're like, oh, you're back to being, you're being honest now. Because people can always feel it vibrationally. When a teacher, I mean, there, and I'm obviously not going to name any names, but there are definitely people that I had as guests even, or other teachers that might have YouTube channels, podcasts, whatever, where maybe, like, there was a little bit of a period of time where I was, like, super into whatever their message was, but then all of a sudden I'm like, there's something not resonating right now, and I think that something just doesn't feel right or real.
Yeah,
and no judgment, but it just, and maybe they change or something, but, like, something doesn't feel authentic.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. If you aren't being authentic, people can feel that.
Yeah, it's definitely very noticeable.
It's so noticeable.
That's why I think it was so helpful for me when I went to Australia earlier this year and I spent, like, 2 months on mushrooms there.
Yes. Okay, back to the psychedelics, because I wanted to segue somehow. Perfect.
But the thing was, is it was really great because when I first got there, a few of the people knew me from what I created on YouTube and, like, were, like, they saw me kind of in a teacher way, but then everyone else didn't know me, so they just saw me as another, like, hippie at this Australia commune hanging out. So it was really good to, like, kind of bridge that gap and become both at once, so people could kind of see what I was doing, but also see that I was there to heal also, because I went there to heal and to get out of the space of being a creator and out of my label and out of this idea of, like, quote-unquote teacher and so forth, and just refocus on what mattered to me and my own practice and so forth. So it was really good for me to open up, because I feel like a lot of the times you get caught in wanting to be your label only, and you get stuck in, like you said, you become one-dimensional, and when you become one-dimensional, you lose your authenticity. So for me, it was like rediscovering my multidimensionality, and that happened, you know, with a huge group of 20, 30 people I spent multiple months with, just laughing and crying and making music with and sipping cacao with and eating mushrooms with. And it was really great to not be just any one of these labels, but to just be and experience the whole of it and, like, rediscover everything for myself and see all these amazing souls and make lots of new amazing friends.
That is so beautiful. I'm so happy you had that experience.
Yeah, Australia's wonderful.
Oh my gosh, I love Australia so much. And I love that you said that about the multi-dimensionality, because we really are. I don't want people to just perceive me as Raquel Mantra, this podcaster who talks about these spiritual woo-woo stuff. Like, there's so much more to me, too. This, I'm so human as well that I just, like, I try to at least, I just want to show myself on stories and stuff. But, you know, it's just people, there's so much more to everybody that you see online. It's almost unfair to create a story and romanticize them.
Yeah.
Whether that be romanticizing them as a teacher or somebody that you see as, like, this life you want
to
live.
And that's why I think I try to keep it. I feel like what helps me kind of keep almost like a friendship basis with lots of students and I guess you could say viewers even, is just that I try to keep everything very grounded. Like, I'm not trying to sit up on a pedestal and be like, I'm the spiritual teacher. It's like, no, I'm a hippie. Like, I'm climbing mountains right now. I'm doing acid and I'm eating mushrooms. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing with my life. But if what I do is helping you too, cool. Let's do it together. You know,
you're just sharing your messages and your life experience, and also, like, the wisdom that you read and are interested in. And I'm sure the universe has, like, have helped you live that wisdom that you had been consuming all these years as well.
I see it as like walking hand in hand versus like standing up on a pedestal, just saying, "Get up here." Like, well, how do they get up there?
Yeah,
you gotta come. You gotta walk them up there, just like you're walking yourself up there.
That has actually been my biggest turnoff lately, I think. Mm-hmm. I've actually just turned some people away on the podcast where I know that they just are looking to raise their status more than just like be one with that, because like people feel that and they see
definitely like you were saying, you're like you're talking about some podcasts you want me to be on, and for me it was like, that'd be cool, but I also authentically want to experience an experience with those people and meet them, rather than, like you said, just like raise your status or
just to be on it. Yeah.
For me, it's like I have to actually feel connected to something like that.
People, for definitely. Sure. Yeah, I get that. And you are at least somewhat connected.
Yeah.
So, LSD.
Back to Lucy.
Okay, wait. Actually, I feel like we should start with one thing that came to mind that I wanted to talk with him about, because I really am interested in exploring the power of psychedelics, because I have a lot of people, a lot of friends that have just really expansive experiences, and I just feel very called to them. Now, if it's something that doesn't resonate with you at all for whatever reason, wonderful. You can just listen with, you know, just from an observer's perspective, but not, you know, no need for you to take any interest, or you don't need to continue the podcast from here, turn it off and move on to the next podcast. But we're going to talk about psychedelics right now, and I'm just interested in knowing how I can begin to explore more. I'm curious about more of Vishuddha's stories, and I think that mushrooms would be a better one for people to maybe begin with.
So I'll preface it by saying that I'm not an expert in any way, shape, or form. This is literally the opinion of a 26-year-old spiritual seeker and sharer of my own life experience. Anything you hear today, don't take it as like fact. You have to do your own research. That's first and foremost. Do your own research completely. Look into your own intuitive calling. If it's there, it's there. If not, it's not. I would say research different teachers like Terrence McKenna, Paul Stamets, who's a really popular mycologist right now and is really good with explaining the benefits of mushrooms, both ones containing psilocybin and ones without.
Psilocybin. So we'll talk about that for a second. But I didn't mean, by the way, to put you on this pedestal psychedelics. I'm just letting people know that
it's just put a warning out there no matter what.
It's so good to put a warning out there.
If this
little
was a
disclaimer.
Video, I have a giant like neon sign saying,
of course, warning. Of course, we have to have those disclaimers. But the reason why I want to talk about this with Vishuddha is, one, well, he's also somebody I deeply trust and, like, you know, just value his opinion, and his experiences are super interesting. But he is somebody when I say I trust, like, he really, I know, does his, like, research deeply. Like, he's not somebody that's just like, oh, this is what I learned from hearsay, all these people. Like, he really is somebody who, he's the real deal. He really does his research, so he's able to thoroughly explain, yet at the same time, it's not like he's studied this so in depth where he's like a master's degree in psychedelics.
I don't have any degrees
in
psychedelics.
It's like, we can relate to him, but at the same time, he also does have great perspectives.
Thank you.
So, mushrooms, okay, so I kind of want to start experimenting with mushrooms a bit just to see what happens.
The first thing with mushrooms is I personally wouldn't suggest somebody start by microdosing. I would suggest them to start with a full trip.
Okay.
Actually tripping, because to microdose is the same, just tell people to start, I guess, to start with, you know, taking a little swig of wine before you start drinking. It's like, well, you don't know what drinking is unless you have you know, you drink and you experience it. Totally different, but that's just kind of, I guess you could say, a little metaphor. But the whole purpose of the psychedelic experience is to basically break down the paradigm by which your mind currently sees reality. So we all have a kind of frame of reference by which we experience everything and react to everything and interact with everything. And the whole purpose of psychedelics is that they open the mind in a way that many of us have not yet had access to. Many of us haven't had time to experience or had the luxury to spend in meditation or these deep spiritual experiences by natural default happening. So the psychedelic experience is more so a slingshot into the depths of your own subconscious and psyche and into the void of existence itself, but in the most beautiful way. So that's why it's so important, if you're going to do it, to kind of go into it fully, to go into the trip. And that's also why if you decide to do psychedelics, it needs to be something that you're really committed to. So when I first started doing them when I was young, I wasn't doing them consciously, but like you said, me and my friends, before we did it and we researched for like a month straight what the benefits were, what the pros and cons were, we weighed it out, and then we realized that it was definitely worth it. We should do it. But you need to have that calling, I think. You have to kind of push that discomfort and try to build that calling within yourself. I wouldn't suggest people if they're like really, really scared to take psychedelics. But I'd also suggest people that if they are really scared to look into themselves and ask why, right? Is it that cultural programming, which usually it is, saying that all these mushrooms are going to make you think you're a glass of orange juice for the rest of your life, or make you throw yourself out a window. These are all these crazy ideas that the Reagan era propaganda machine thought up in the, you know, late 60s and 70s to kind of push people away from the hippie revolution and get them out of, put them in a state of fear of these things, which is what a lot of us have right now. Virtually everyone I meet that has a fear of psychedelics is based on these propagandized things, you know, not wanting to leave the way they're living or change the way they are. But it has to be something you're really drawn to and called to. If you really want to change, if you really feel like you're not making any headway or progress in your spiritual practice, psychedelics are what we call an option. You know, they're a potential way for you to change that over the course of just a few hours.
Yeah.
Another thing I would say is that when it comes to psychedelics, I've noticed that a lot of people also are afraid of a bad trip and they're worried about having bad trips. But the biggest thing that I've come to realize, especially after not using them for 5 years and then reintegrating them heavily over this past year, is that bad trips really only occur when we're trying to control the experience. So the most beautiful part of the psychedelics experience is that they teach you. If you listen, you can learn a lot from the psychedelic experience. You realize a lot. Things kind of become clear. Just like when you're watching a movie or you're listening to comedy and you hear a joke, you get it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be explained to. You just, those aha moments. Mm-hmm. Those come through in spades in the psychedelic experience. And that's why it's so helpful spiritually to help you start to understand what universal oneness is and what this multidimensionality of reality might mean and what it means to have this one life and live it fully. It helps you break through these things you might have never really thought about. But you have to be able to let go in order to do so. The same way that to enjoy a roller coaster, you have to let go of the bars and put your hands up in the air. Mm-hmm. And then once you do that, you're like, I can actually flow with this roller coaster. I'm not like clenching on and hurting myself. Psychedelics are the same way. If you can learn to experience it fully and accept the kind of the discomfort and comfort that comes with it, you'll have these massive, massive, beautiful experiences throughout it.
Man, that's with any psychedelic. Every psychedelic also does have their own unique
experiences. Very different. They're all very different.
What are the ones you've done?
I've only really done mushrooms and psychedelics fully. I tried DMT when I was younger, but it wasn't something that I would say, I've done DMT.
And so you've only like microdosed LSD.
But I've not done huge doses of LSD as well. Yeah. I did a full dose at Annapurna. I had more. I had more after we were up there. But then there's also like research chemicals, which I don't suggest, like 2CI, 25I, NBOME, all these different research chemicals that came after LSD, which
noted,
do have toxicity rates and stuff.
Where does LSD come from if it's natural?
LSD is synthesized. So it's synthesized from ergo, like the rye and fungi on bread. So it comes from a fungi, just like psilocybin. Yeah. But it was synthesized by Albert Hofmann, the scientist, in I think 1934 or 43, maybe I have them backwards. But he basically was working with these compounds, trying to synthesize pure chemicals, and he spilled some on his hand. And so it's called Bicycle Day. It's actually a holiday for for psychedelic users.
Wow.
But it's the day that he discovered LSD, dropped it on his hand, he was riding his bike home and started tripping, just massively tripping in the middle of, I think it's Switzerland or Sweden. But being the scientist he is, he went back to work the next day and dropped more acid on his hand to confirm it was.
Was that,
And then it was. And he realized what he discovered. It shifted his whole life, changed his whole reality, made him rethink God, religion, everything. Terrence McKenna even has this thing where he talks about basically saying that you don't really live life unless you've had a psychedelic experience. Like, if you go to your grave without ever having a psychedelic experience, you can't say you've lived.
Damn.
Because it's truly opening you up to a new dimension of existence and a new yeah. dimension of experience itself. That's why it's also, there's so many different things that go into like having a good trip, you know, and setting the intentions before you trip, having somebody trip sit you if it's your first time, like having someone sober there to take care of you, to like make you drinks
sure.
and stuff, keep you comfortable if you want to stay indoors. If you're going to be outdoors, making sure it's a safe space you know really well, or you can have somebody again sit with you in, not just going out in the middle of somewhere you don't know and doing it if you've never done it before. There's so many different things to take into account, you know.
That's probably super important to make sure that you
yeah.
have someone around. There's a lot of probably a lot of reasons why
yeah.
that is immensely important. But what about if you're with somebody super experienced and they're also doing,
that's perfect. That's
yeah.
the best thing you can do for your first time is to be with somebody who's already done psychedelics.
Yeah.
Because they kind of are like by de facto a teacher for you. Not a
and
teacher,
not
but
like
a guy.
Once or twice, but
yeah.
like
how we hiked on a porno, we had a guy
yeah.
with us, and he
yeah.
knows the route. He's done it 50 times.
Yeah.
He can answer all our questions,
yeah.
quell all our worries and all our fears.
Yeah.
An experienced tripper can do the same thing. So if it's your first time doing mushrooms or LSD, and you're with a friend or someone who's done it plenty of times, they can calm you down, they can help you relax, they can confirm everything's okay, all this different stuff,
right.
let you know it's going to be fine, show you easy ways to have deep experiences, like closed eye visuals where you place your hands over your eyes and let the kind of rods and cones in your eyes go crazy and see these fractalized colors and patterns.
Wow.
They can take you outside at night and tell you to look at the stars and take it all in. There's just lots of good things that it's best to do it with somebody who's experienced tripping or the trip sitter. I wouldn't suggest just do it by yourself.
By yourself for your
first
time.
Yeah.
For sure.
Just because it's leaving yourself open to unpleasant variables. You know, it's unnecessary.
Yeah. Well, and also there's a lot of negative side effects that can happen. For example, with ayahuasca, obviously you need a shaman or somebody
yeah.
with you.
Caretakers, exactly.
Caretakers, you definitely do, because people throw up. They might even have seizures, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And so they definitely need a caretaker there. And DMT, I know there's a lot of, there's like a burning sensation or something like that.
In DMT, you totally leave your body, like you're gone. They're just kind of watching your
wow.
body while you're off in consciousness.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I've had friends do it, and it's just, it's almost as if you like slump over, but it's just, you're gone into the DMT dimension, and they're just making sure your body's okay while you're there.
That's so interesting. Isn't there, though, like, when you first do it, or there's, like, a cough or, like, a burning cough or throw or something like that, that it's really...
Some people say it smells like burning plastic or something also.
Interesting.
But, yeah, it's usually a cough. Most people smoke it or, like, vaporize it.
Yeah.
Kind of,
yeah,
way,
they
like,
vaporize it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
What are some negative side effects that people might need to, like, look out for?
The thing with mushrooms is making sure that you're actually eating psychedelic mushrooms. And that's why it's important to do your research.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't suggest... So when I was in Australia...
Could you have a poisonous one?
What was that?
Could you have a poisonous one?
If you don't know what you're doing. And that's
yeah.
why it's important to do your research, right? That's why in the beginning I'm like looking to Paul Stamets, because he's a really good mycologist
mm-hmm.
and he has mushroom growers guides and guides that show you the psilocybin mushrooms in your area and like where you live.
Yeah.
You can research it as well. That's also, you know, if... I wish we could talk about where you can get psychedelics, but in certain countries you can just get them in shops, like in Holland and stuff.
Right.
You can get them. It's just about knowing what a psychedelic mushroom looks like, what a psilocybin-based
yeah.
mushroom looks like, where
what
you
is psilocybin?
Live.
It's the psychoactive ingredient.
Psilocybin's like the chemical compound in the mushroom that causes the effect in the brain,
right?
The psychedelic experience. But one way it's easy to see is a lot of the times, at least in Australia, where we were, is that the stem turns blue when it's really dense
mm-hmm.
with psilocybin. It has a reaction to oxygen.
Oh.
So when you know kind of what it looks like as well, just to make sure you can like squeeze the stem and it turns blue, okay, that has psilocybin, and you take them.
That is insane. You lived on a mushroom farm and you were able to just like, basically a mushroom farm.
Lived on a farm with mushrooms, definitely.
Yes.
Most definitely. Lots of them. But that's why it's like wherever you're at in the world, you know, if you're in the Pacific Northwest of America, you can research which mushrooms grow in that area.
Yeah.
If you're in Florida, you can research which ones grow in that area.
But for the first time, they should probably just find someone that...
Yeah, if you can find someone that sells them. I mean, I've never in my life met somebody who sells mushrooms who doesn't sell a psychedelic mushroom. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're not going to just go find a random mushroom in the woods and sell it to you. That'll land them in prison. So that rarely ever happens. If you're getting mushrooms from whoever your like weed dealer is or something, if
yeah.
you have that, they're usually legitimate mushrooms.
Right.
Just make sure they're not giving you like portobello mushrooms or something you're getting ripped off.
Portobello.
It's easier that way. And you can use test kits. Test kits are good ways to do it too, where you put little pieces in it. You can do it with LSD also. They have test kits where you can drop little pieces of your blotter in or a little piece of the mushroom in, and you shake it up. And if it turns the right color, you know you have the right compound.
Curious about your experience, Annapurna.
Yeah. Oh, Annapurna was great. A lot of Annapurna was kind of just feeling the mountain. Mm-hmm. So.
And this is your LSD experience, yes?
Yeah. This is on LSD and Annapurna. Like, a lot of the hike up there, I just kept thinking that I'm hiking this mountain. I'm hiking up this mountain.
You were pretty, like, singular focused.
Yeah, meditating. Mountains are a very meditative practice for me. I'm in my own zone. I don't talk very much. I'm very in the experience. That's why I figured you were probably having the same really deep, like, experiences for yourself as well, because you were alone a lot of the trek. And I was alone in the front a lot, too.
We were both alone pretty much the entire trek.
Yeah.
And Haley as well, like, all of us were.
And it's really good for your mind to just zone into the moment.
We just needed that time for ourselves, because it would be nice. We had the moments in between where we'd all get together, have some coffee, tea, just socialize a little bit.
And then continue back into our meditative
walks. And
when I got to the top, though, and I had the psychedelics, I went up to the big ridge where all the memorials are, and I walked all the way to the back, and I could see the huge drop-off. And the whole time I've been hiking, I kept thinking about how, like, I was hiking this mountain, and I was going up to Annapurna. And the more I got up there and the more I sat there, I started to feel that interconnectedness with the mountain, that I'm not just hiking up Annapurna, that I am Annapurna, that I'm this mountain moving into this giant land mass known as the Indochina, I guess you could say, the Chinese-Russian land mass. I'm not sure what the name of it is. But that I was I was simultaneously this small moving organic compound, but also the entire, you know, geological structure itself over billions of years, and that my energy just happened to be in this place and time where I could self-perceive it or self-witness it and feel that. And it was really beautiful, like, you know, when you sit up there in the quiet, what's so great is that in the mountain, all you hear is just the rocks cracking and the ice cracking, and this literally, that's what's so powerful about being in a glacial area like that in the Himalayas, is you can hear the earth moving, the entire planet moving in that space.
That was surreal.
Yeah, the crust of the earth bending below the other one, and one rising and rising and rising. And usually things like impermanence can scare us, and how short and quick the, you know, human experience is. But when you're in that state, the LSD kind of opens you up to, like, how beautiful it is. It stops being a scary thing. And that's a lot of it what the spiritual path is too, is can you love the fear as much as you love the joy, right? Can you love the pain as much as you love the happiness or the pleasure? And so LSD really opens that up, and that's what I was feeling, is like not scared or not sad that my life is so short in comparison to, say, the mountain that is Annapurna being millions of years old. It's more so a thankfulness that I get to experience that thought at all, that realization that, wow, I'm something right here, seeing some other aspect of myself.
That's not even just a thought. I mean, that's really, truly just an embodiment of feeling of oneness.
Yeah. Like, that's what it felt like.
Pure oneness.
And then what was also really interesting was that when we went down the mountain, before we went down, I went out at that. I had a smaller amount at first and went out and sat there and was kind of taking that in. And then went back before I filmed, I took some more. So I had a little bit, but I figured I would go a little deeper and I took some more. And that's when I went and filmed a few videos. But once we started heading back down the mountain, this huge cloud rolled in above us, that giant cloud. And it overtook everything. At first, you could see the entire mountain and all the range and everything and the blue sky and this huge, thick cloud sort of crawling up the mountain, because in this mountain range, the wind is so strong that it blows up from the valley into the Annapurna mountain range and drops all the snow and rain there. So this cloud was literally climbing up the mountain, something I've never seen before. Usually you see clouds going down, this cloud was going up over us. And I felt like almost like a dinosaur. Like I was in like thousands of years ago and feeling this kind of spatial difference between this era and that era, and how these mountains were still there, and just trying to perceptualize these shifts in time, how far and wide they can be, because One thing humans are really bad at is time and like distance. We can understand things from 1 to 100, but when we get to like thousands and tens of thousands and millions, our brain just physically is not strong enough or mentally capable of processing that like size difference. So it was really interesting not to feel like I didn't feel like I was a physical like T-Rex or something, but I felt like that prehistoric age and the plants and ficuses up there are so ancient, and just living in the middle of winter somehow, it felt very, very ancient, very, very classical. Wow. And it was this really cool experience of bridging those like timelines of these mountains were still there when the dinosaurs were here. They were still there in the Jurassic era and the Triassic era and the Paleolithic era.
Yeah.
So it was really, really cool to be up in that space and be feeling that, and doing so, you know, in that state was, you know, a really unique experience. It was a lot of fun.
Powerful.
And it's one of the few areas you can see that, you know, and we're in a city right now filming this podcast, and you can't be here and say, oh, this is all something that I can relate to hundreds of thousands of years ago being here.
I know.
Even the lakes, you know, lakes change, but these mountain ranges are some of the oldest on the entire planet.
Well, you can see, I remember someone, it was you, that was like, it almost looks Jurassic Park. And I was looking around and I was thinking about that too. And as a child, because I grew up in Utah, and apparently, I mean, we have like our dinosaur areas. Yeah. And I would just like look around as a little girl, because you're so imaginative at the time, and I would just picture the different dinosaurs roaming around those lands.
Yeah.
And so I would have my own, I guess, trips as a child. But I was so curious about your experience and that oneness, that pure oneness that you got to feel. I think that is, though it's a concept, I understand and I feel and I see when I really deeply connect with others and nature, it's something that I really want to fully embody, and as I know that that's truth.
All is in the one, and the one is in all.
Yeah. We're all just an extension of the same thing. And so when we're tracking that, we're all part of our consciousness, part of ourselves that we're checking. And so that was beautiful.
Yeah, and that's what, like, one of the final things I realized on it, too, was down at the base when you were kind of asking, and I was like, I'm still tripping a bit, was that, like, the devil really is in the details, as in, like, details cause us to fall out of oneness, you know? So when we got down to our, the lower base camp, we were staying for the night, my trip was still going pretty strong, and everyone was in the other room, and you guys were all in your rooms, and I was sitting out on that boulder. Yeah. But I was watching this huge boulder off in the distance, and since the fog was so strong, it was so strong that the boulder almost started disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed in my own psyche that the denser the fog got, the more beautiful the boulder appeared, because it was just this outline of the boulder, and it was very soft, and it meshed almost with the fog, and the colors were very soft and gentle. And I could kind of feel that unionization, that fading into of each other, the fog and the boulder. But then as soon as the fog would let up, I could see the whole boulder. I could see the crags and the cracks and the imperfections and the water stains and the quote-unquote ugliness. You know, your ego mind gets in and goes, oh, this boulder has a chip there, and it's not as pretty here as it is over there. And those plants are kind of ugly because they're like a really weird brown color. And all those details make something uglier, makes it separate. And every time that the fog would let up, I would see just the boulder, and it would be like almost this like sandpaper in my mind.
Yeah.
It would just be very uncomfortable. And then as soon as this fog got really dense again, it would merge back into this beautiful like hueish, greenish, brownish, blackish color that merged into the fog. And so it made me realize how much that the reason it's so hard for us to feel that oneness is because we get so caught up in perceiving things and identifying things and detailing every little thing we do. And that's why for me, like you guys kind of noticed when we were hiking, is I'm just kind of flowing with things.
Yeah.
Because I noticed for my mind, just like the trip showed me, is that the more I identify stuff, the less I love it. Because your ego just keeps trying to rip things apart and pick things apart and nitpick everything, because it's what we do in the West. We individualize everything rather than seeing reality as the collective consciousness it is, the oneness it is. So it was a really good reminder for me to step back and stop doing that, and you know, not just to do it when I'm on acid in the mountains looking at a boulder in the fog, but even now in like Pokhara in the middle of this Nepalese city, to while I'm walking down the sidewalk, not nitpick all these little things, but just kind of see the blur of being that's kind of playing in front of me. So Just little things like that are what psychedelics teach you and show you. And then your choice when you experience that is, am I going to take this as a one-off trip that I can, you know, geek out about, or am I going to actually write this down and try to practice this in my life? And that's why setting intentions is so important. And again, deciding where and when you trip is really important too.
That was beautiful. I remember actually you told me to sit there when you were like, I asked when you're like, you know, you should meditate and stare at that boulder and watch the fog go in and out. It's really cool. And so I did.
I was experiencing too much to explain what I had seen yet, but I was like, you should just look at the boulder.
Yeah, I got it. It was beautiful. See what you saw, but I do see how that would actually be such an interesting experience, because you can see also that when the boulder does come into full detail, you're reminded like, oh, when they clear everything and everything is released, like this is the purity of what it actually is. Mm-hmm. And it's all imperfect.
Yeah.
Vishuddha, I love you.
Love you too.
So much. I'm so thankful that we've had this experience.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's good to chat before you head off to, where are you going next?
Well, Kathmandu, but then Kathmandu. Bali.
Bali, yeah. Have fun in Bali. I'll be in South Korea next.
I am so excited for your South Korea and then Japan. Just a few days. Yeah. By the way, 3 years ago when we met, he said that there are two places he hadn't traveled yet, the world.
None.
He was like, when I do though, there are two stops that I have to make, and that are India and Japan.
Yeah.
And guess what? He's got India checked. That was like your
5
world.
Months in India.
Yeah, 5 months, no big
Great
deal.
Time.
And Japan is coming up. So this is like huge for
manifestation
this anime lover.
Practice. Manifestation in
yes.
action.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm excited for it.
Well, Jai Ma.
Jai Ma.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Yomis, that is a wrap. I hope this episode was expanding for you in some way, shape, or form. Feel free to visit our site at yourownmagic.com or check out my shop, eyesofaspen.com. Connect with the other Your Own Magic listeners. We would love to see more conversations started on the Your Own Magic Facebook group. So with all that being said, thank you so much again for tuning in, and I hope you have a magical rest of your day.